And now let's give a warm, special Santa Barbara welcome to our main speaker, Lee C. from Santa Maria.
Right on. Thanks. My name's Lee. I'm an alcoholic.
Lee.
Just want to take the thing. First of all, I want to thank Jordan for the invitation to come talk. I haven't been here since before COVID. It's been a long time. Hey, Michael. Nice to see you. And all y'all. That first thing, I want to thank Jordan for the invitation, Lisa, and all of y'all for the warm welcome. It is amazing to get welcome the way you guys do it here. There used to be even more greeters at the door, you know. So now it's still cool though. And I was going to individually thank all part of my tribe, the Santa Maria tribe, the pocket of enthusiasm that we have in Santa Maria. But you got to meet them all because they all stood up. Except Charlotte, though, she's in Al-Anon, and Tiffany, so that she, well, the wives and significant others. But, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, man. It's good to be invited here. It's good to be back. My wife, of course, coming down, daughter, et cetera, et cetera, the whole deal. I'm going to talk about Danny. You guys all know Billy already, but I'm going to throw him under the bus a little bit too, probably. We'll see. What else? Tower Records, our new guy with Tower Records. That's pretty cool, man. Yeah. That's amazing. And that was the other thing that was a little strange, unusual, that there's probably a bunch of y'all in the back that just didn't stand up, right? Or she didn't give you a chance to stand up quick enough, or you didn't stand up quick. Because there used to be a lot of newcomers here, and I bet you there are some here tonight. So welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Hopefully I can help you feel a little bit like I do, you know, in part of this thing of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go different areas when I talk. So tonight, let's see. I'll start with born in San Diego. Grew up in San. I'm a beach rat, so you Santa Barbara people can relate to that. A beach rat. Grew up in Mission Beach in San Diego. I don't remember. My dad never had. Single mom on welfare. I am not an alcoholic because my mom was on welfare, but what that did affect, the huge effect that did have on me, that it took me a long, long, long time to be able to buy name brand items at the store. You know, I was frugal because I was poor. You know, we didn't have any money, and you bought the cheapest you could buy. It didn't matter what it tasted like. I remember food stamps, growing up on food stamps. Used to be food stamps were like Monopoly money. It was fake money, and you used to have to use it at the store, you know, and it was embarrassing. I mean, embarrassing. But even before food stamps, some of y'all are going to remember this. Remember commodities? Commodity was pre-food stamps. Commodities was food. It was like a big thing of cheese, and it said cheese on it. That was it. Like Acme cheese. It didn't have any ingredients. It was peanut butter in a can. You had to use the machine to get it open, and then all that oil would be at the top, and you had to stir it up, and it just said peanut butter. I mean, that's what it was, and it tasted terrible, but it was free food, and that's what I had. You know, I didn't have a dad. Didn't know my found him when I was 25 years old, but that's another different story. Grew up, as I said, in San Diego. I don't remember my first drink. I've asked God. I prayed about it. I don't know. I remember in sixth grade, so that's like 11 or 12 years old, I remember in sixth grade stealing Schlitz malt liquor out of the back of Thrifty Drugstore. Because you could just grab it and run out the door, and they just kind of used to let us go or whatever. And I was talking about that one time, true story, I was talking about that one time, Schlitz malt liquor. And it was in Lompoc. And I was like, you know, I don't even know if they make Schlitz malt liquor anymore. And there was a newcomer in the back nodding his head. Yeah, they do. Yeah, Schlitz malt liquor in Southern Comfort, right? You remember Southern Comfort? Yeah. You mentioned Southern Comfort in an AA meeting, and people started drooling. You know, it's like an aphrodisiac or something, you know. It's just everybody drank Southern Comfort. And so that was 11 or 12 years old. I don't know. What I was told anyways, I usually talk a little bit about my mom and childhood and whatnot, but tonight I'm not going to spend all that much time on it. But I have 60s was the Vietnam. I grew up born in the early 60s, raised in the 60s, early 70s was my big deal, and when I was in the teens and all that. And I remember peace marches and love-ins at Balboa Park, a bunch of long-haired guys smoking pot, all that stuff. I remember, I couldn't tell you who ran for president 20, 15, 20, 30 years ago, but I know in 1972 it was Nixon and McGovern, right? Because Nixon was like the antichrist to my mom, and McGovern was the guy. My mom is left-wing. My mom is very, very left-wing. And I don't say that with any tone or any judgment. It's just my mom is so far left, she's a danger to oncoming traffic, man. I mean, she's over there, right? And when I turned, I moved out on my own at 17. I joined the military as soon as I could. I went into the Army. And my mom was not in favor of that, I tell you. It was one of the first, that was one of the decisions she was completely against, thought it was a huge mistake, and it actually turned out to be one of the best things I've ever done. Because that's where I got money to go to college. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I went to military, I joined the military. I came home on leave that first year, that first month, few months I was in. I went to boot camp and we went to Thanksgiving dinner, where we always went to Thanksgiving dinner. Every November we went to this house, friends of my mom, same political persuasion, same very left. And I'm in my military uniform. And I'm proud of my military. I'm proud. I just come out of boot camp. I'd eaten three meals a day for the first time in my life, I think. I gained weight in boot camp. And my mom's friends were teasing me about the uniform, and they didn't get to me. I was okay. I was okay with it. I was okay being in the military. I was proud of it. And then they said something that did get to me. And what they said is, you know, you look sharp in that uniform today, but you remember that time you were 5 years old, we gave you that hit of acid? You were tripping that day, man. And I was like, what? You guys gave me acid when I was 5 years old? I was angry, pissed off, and resentful about that for years, decades, until when? You know when I got free of it? When I put mom on paper. Mom, I had my first sponsor, actually wasn't my first sponsor, but when the sponsor, when I finally did the work, he said, just put mom on paper, nobody else. And I said, mom's been on every inventory I've done. He said, I don't care, just do mom. And when I did that, I got free of it because I finally did it on mom, you know. And there was a guy, some of y'all have been around long enough, remember Bob Earl, right? Remember Bob Earl? Yeah, it's getting along. Not many people remember him anymore, but Bob Earl was one of my heroes, right? And Bob Earl said it best. I took it from him. And what he said and what I learned from him is my mom did the best she could with the tools she had. Thank you, Mom. I love you. Period. That's it. I used to say, but. And then not anymore. Not anymore. My mom did the best she could, and I appreciate that. Now it's just part of my story that I was eating acid at five. All right, you know. It's not unique. There's some, maybe even in here, there's somebody else doing it. My wife, you know, when she was 5 years old, her parents were giving her pot and acid too. I'm like, damn, if we could have met back then, we'd have been married a whole lot longer, you know. But we didn't meet till we met here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did that. I remember, like I said, stealing six packs of beer. I didn't have a dad in my life. My idea of men, of a real man, was up there on the silver screen, up in the movies, and John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, those were my guys, right? Like that, you know, and what did they drink? Whiskey, that's what they drank. So when I matured at about the age of 14, if I'm buying, man, I'm buying whiskey. Jack Daniels, period. That's what I'm going to buy, you know, because that's what they did, and that's what real men drink. You know, The Outlaw Josey Wales, that's my favorite movie of all time. And you know how some people know Rocky Horror Picture Show? You still have it in Santa Barbara, probably. If you go to Rocky Horror Picture Show and you go into the theater, you can't even hear the speakers because so many people are talking along with the soundtrack. I know Josey Wales like most people know Rocky Horror Picture Show. And 1 hour and 28 minutes into that movie, and it depends, don't come up to me after the meeting and correct me, because it depends on the edited version. You might have the original, you might have that TV, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's 1 hour and 28 minutes in, Josey Wales rides into a ghost town. Pretty much a ghost town. There's some people in it. He walks into the saloon. They're all bantering back and forth. And they look at him and go, oh. And they say, what'll it be, partner? And Josey Wales says, whiskey. And they laugh. Whiskey? We ain't had whiskey here. This town's been dried up for years. We might have a warm beer in the back. So Josey Wales walks out. And then in that Hollywood fashion, you hear his spurs clinking as he comes back towards the door. He kicks open those batwing doors. He's got a case of whiskey in one hand and two bottles of whiskey in the other hand, and he's the man, right? They love him. He gets the girl, kills all the bad guys. His former enemy respects him in the end of the movie, man. And I want to be just like Josey Wales, so I'm going to drink Jack Daniels, right? Unfortunately, in the real world, what you get is a suspended sentence for assault and battery. That's what you get in the real world. You know, you don't get the girl. She doesn't know. Or John Wayne. If John Wayne would have walked into the saloon and mosey on over to the bartender and said, you know, pass the crack pipe, pilgrim, you'd have a different speaker, because I'd have been smoking crack, man. But John Wayne did not ask for a crack pipe. John Wayne asked for whiskey. And that's what I drank, whiskey, growing up, you know. I heard stories Like I mentioned, my wife, you know, young, and I heard another story, a kid in the L.A. area, like kindergarten, that's 4 or 5, I think, 5 years old, kindergarten, came home from school and he told his mom he'd learned a new word from the big kids. And she said, "You learned a new word from the big, what word did you learn from the big kids?" And he said, "Er." And she said, "Er? How do you spell it?" And he goes, "I don't know, Mom." And she said, "Well, how did you learn it? What was the context of it when the big kids taught it to you?" And he said, "That's easy, Mom. They went like this. Oh, there's some potheads out here. I'm not a pothead. I didn't like pot. That doesn't mean if you went, I didn't go, because I would, right? I don't want to be in this head. I want to be out of it. I will smoke pot if you got it. But I don't like pot all that much. You know, I moved out on my own at 17, man. I had enough money for booze and rent, right? You smoke a doobie and get the munchies, go to the refrigerator. What do you got? Ketchup packets from McDonald's, man. That's what you got, right? But you got the munchies and cotton mouth, so you eat them. You know, or Top Ramen. You'd always have Top Ramen. Top Ramen was 10 cents a pack 50 years ago. And you can find it on sale 10 cents a pack today. Why can't anything else be like Top Ramen? You know, or macaroni and cheese, right? You might have some macaroni and cheese. What's the problem with macaroni and cheese? You don't have any milk. You don't have any butter, right? But you got ketchup packets and the munchies, so you mix it all together. Yeah, no, no. My best friend back in the day, Ronnie D, his dad was a dealer, man, and he used to have the Kind pot. And pot used to have seeds in it. You know, these kids are going, "What?" Yep, used to have seeds in it, man. And we used to have these things called record albums from Tower Records. We got them from Tower Records. Yeah, that's where we got them. Tower Records. And we used to, you'd break the pot up. Unless you just bought a pair of shoes, you might have a top to a shoe box. That was even better because it would, you'd break it up, and then you'd lift it up, and the seeds would roll down, and then you'd roll your joint, you know, and smoke it. But, yeah, no, I'm not big. Speed? No. No, thank you, man. I am a neat freak as it is. My house is clean. I am neat. My mom is, never mind, neat. I'm neat. I'm neat. I like clean. And I do not enjoy the sensation of my eyes beating me into the next room. You know, I don't like it. So no, no, no. That doesn't mean if you're going to, you got some speed or, you know, you're going to share it with me. Yeah. Cocaine? No. No, thank you. Uh-uh. You know, I don't like the high on cocaine. I don't like that jittery. I don't like that coming down feeling on cocaine. I don't like the expense of cocaine. You know how many fifths of Jack Daniels I can buy with what you're paying for that cocaine? Uh-uh. I'm buying Jack Daniels, baby. That does not mean if you handed me a mirror lined with some lines railed out, I wouldn't snort it, because I would, right? Because I don't want to be in here. But I didn't like it much. Now, acid. I loved acid, man. Acid was cheap. It was quick. It was easy. I could have been reliving some childhood memories. Didn't even know it, right? But the problem with acid is you can't take acid and convince even yourself that you're maintaining, right? Because you know no one saw that car. You know nobody. You know. And as I said, I joined the military as soon as I had 18, a little earlier than 18 it was actually. And in my day, if they caught you using drugs, they kicked you out, man. There was no rehab, no treatment. So I quit using drugs just like that. I am not an addict, man. I'll share. I'll do anything you want to share with me. But if it's from my choice, I'm going to drink. And I went in the military, I went in the Army, I went in a thing called Special Forces, also known as what? The Green Berets. Green Berets. Why would I be a Green Beret? John Wayne was a Green Beret. John Wayne was a Green Beret. I was a Green Beret, man. Now, I was at the Goleta meeting here. It's a true story. At the Goleta meeting here, Sunday at 7 o'clock. So this is probably 25, 30 years ago, maybe. I don't know, maybe not quite that. 25 years ago. That's my story. It's true. That's a fact. You know, if John Wayne would have been a Navy SEAL, I'd enjoy the Navy. But John Wayne was a Green Beret, so I was a Green Beret. And after the meeting at Goleta, there was I don't remember the guy's name, but the generation above mine, he thanked me in the thank you line. And in all seriousness, not being critical, he said, "You know, John Wayne was a Marine before he was a Green Beret." And I was like, "I didn't see that movie, man. I saw the Green Berets, right?" And that's, and like I said, for me, the military back then, the slogan was, "It's a great place to start." And that is how I got money to go to college and all that stuff. The system worked for me. The welfare got me fed as a kid, all that stuff. I had a big brother from Big Brothers of America. Because of him, you know, I got promoted really well, quickly in the military. I got up to E6 the day at 5.5 years. The earliest you can get promoted, I got promoted. I'd been to the board before I was eligible. And then on the day I was eligible, they made me an E6. I was in Central America, in Panama, back when Nicaragua and El Salvador were hot. And so there's all kinds of drugs all around, but I'm drinking. And I called my big brother from Panama, and I said, "Hey, I just got promoted. I just made E6, you know." Wow, he was real proud of me. He said, "But why did you join the military in the first place?" I said, to give money to go to college. And he said, mission accomplished. And I go, oh, okay, yeah. And so I ended up getting out, and I moved up here to Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo. That's how we ended up on the Central Coast. And on December 10th, 1987, actually on December 9th, 1987, I took my last final at Cal Poly. And I came home, and I opened a fifth of whiskey just to get buzzed. And the next morning when I woke up or came to, I went to the front room and there was like a finger's width left in that bottle. And I looked at the woman I was married to at that time and I said, how much of this did you drink? And she said, none of it. And I said, man, I did it again. I did it. I had not intended to drink a fifth of whiskey all by myself again. So I made some phone calls, or a phone call, I don't remember the process actually, but I found out where the AA thing was, and I went to the noon meeting at the Pioneer Group in San Luis Obispo. Big book study, it was a big book study. Couldn't tell you who was there except for one guy, Jack L., Jack Lanigan. And the reason I couldn't have no idea what was read, but the reason I know Jack was there is because Jack came up to me after the meeting and said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he started to talk to me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He welcomed me to this program that we have. He welcomed me into Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I really wasn't ready yet. I didn't drink again, but December 10th, 1987, my sobriety date, but I didn't become a part of this for a long time, but that's a little further down. But Jack talked to me and he had a book just like this one. It was a third edition, so it had a blue cover, but it was just like this one. And he tried to give it to me. He said, here's a big book, take it and read it, and this is our program. And I wouldn't take it. I'm like, no thanks. And he continued to try, and I wouldn't take it. And the reason I wouldn't take it, not because I wasn't interested in what you had. I was. I can't drink. I can go periods of time. No problem. Day, week, month, no problem. I cannot drink. But when I start drinking, get out of the way. Because I'm not stopping until I'm drunk, blacked out, passed out. But the reason I wouldn't take it is because, as I said, I was going to Cal Poly at the time. Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. I was paying 60, 70 bucks for books like this at Cal Poly. And I didn't know, to me, that's what a book like this cost. And at school, you could sell it back at the end of the quarter. I didn't think AA would buy it back. So, but Jack told me the deal, so I took it. I did have it, and now I carry him with me in my truck. And this is one of the ones out of my truck. If anybody in this room tonight needs a big book, this one is for you. You can have it free. I'll give it to you. No problem. So Jack taught me 38 years ago. And I'm still doing it today. One time I was talking in Yosemite, Saturday Night Speaker at Yosemite. We did that. We did the countdown. And there's a young man got up at, no, a young lady got up at 4 days. And everybody's clapping, woohoo. And then a guy got up at 3 days. Everybody's clapping. And that guy got up. He got the big book. So when I was up here talking and I started getting into the resentments, which I don't know if we'll see where I go tonight. But I started talking about resentments. And I go, so for those of you that don't know what a resentment is, that young lady there with 4 days, she's got resentment because that guy with 3 days got the big book. But I tell you what, you can have this book, I said to her. And she got up, 3,000 people in the room. She got up right then and came up and took the book. And everybody's clapping and it was amazing. If that talk sucked, if I was the worst speaker you ever heard, it didn't matter. That was worth it right there. That was worth it right there just to give that young lady a book. And I also talked about, I'll bring it up now, I didn't read this book forever. 5.5 years, I was stark raving sober. I didn't read this book. And I heard somebody share one time at the Village Group in Rio Grande. It was a woman. I don't know if she was a visitor. It wasn't one of our regulars, but she talked about reading 2 pages a day. 2 pages a day. I'm like, that's stupid. Probably what some of y'all just thought. That's stupid. That's stupid. They're in chapter. You got to read them in chapter because they're in chapters. But the problem with the chapter is what? It takes too long to read a chapter. It takes 10, 15 minutes to read a chapter, man. I don't have 10, 15 minutes to devote to my sobriety. But 2 minutes? 2 minutes? 2 pages? That takes 60 to 90 seconds. Depends if there's any hard words, man. And I've been reading 2 pages a day, absolutely no matter what, for about 30 years now. 30 years, probably. Maybe 29, 28. A long time. And I know the book. Am I trying to impress you? Absolutely. There are people drunk who know the book better than I do. It's just a tool that's been laid at my feet that I chose to pick up. And then why I brought that story up, I was smoking back then, and it was raining in Yosemite that night. And after the meeting, I took my coat and tie off. And we were, those of us that were smoking were in this shed, this woodshed, because it was raining, so we were in this woodshed. And this young lady, another young lady, she said, "Hey, weren't you our speaker tonight?" And I said, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was." And she said, "You know what, that 2 pages a day, that seems like a really good idea. I think I'm going to do that." So again, if I was the worst speaker they'd ever, they regretted bringing me to Yosemite to talk. It didn't matter because that woman, that person heard something that night. So maybe something tonight, who knows? Oh, by the way, I know I'm supposed to end at 8:50. I will end at 8:50. I know a couple of you have a few blocks to drive home tonight. I'll get you out of here on time, right? Don't worry, you know. My home group, by the way, is the Thursday night men's stag in Santa Maria. My sponsor's a guy named Bob D in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I was also thinking while I was sitting here, it's kind of cool. I don't know if you guys can hear it, but up in the front we can. It's like, you got a good deal here. If the speaker's boring, you can edit the speakers out and just listen to the frogs and the crickets and use it, you know. I can't remember the name of that play. I have it at my house. I have this old sound machine from the day. It's on 24/7 with crickets and frogs chirping. Just like, I love it, man. That's what we go to sleep to. But, so anyway, 5.5 years. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I didn't do anything except for not drink. I thought that's what this was. I wasn't listening to you people. I'm going to college at the time and former Green Beret, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I'm an accountant by trade. What's some plumber going to teach me about an inventory? I know what inventories are. 5.5 years, what I call stark raving sober. And then through a series of events at 5.5 years, I got checked into a psych ward. A psych ward at French Hospital. And you don't got to raise your hands. I know I got some brothers and sisters out here. Yeah, I know. I ain't the only one. And that's when my life changed. You know, for 5.5 years, I admitted, on December 10th, 1987, I admitted that I'm powerless over alcohol. I can't drink it. But my life unmanageable? Come on. I'm a former Green Beret. I had a wife, 2 kids at that time, a 3.8 GPA, working at UPS in the morning as a teamster. Great job, great union. Going to school during the day. My life unmanageable? No, thank you very much. I'm doing fine. But the thing of it is that people who are managing their lives well don't end up in a psych ward. That's not where you go when you're managing your life well. You just don't. They don't go, "Hey, you're doing really good. You want to go in a psych ward?" No, they don't do that. You got to be pretty low, not managing well, to get admitted to a psych ward. And that's where I ended up. And there were a lot of things about the psych ward I'd share, but tonight I'll just share. I did my first inventory in that psych ward. I brought a big book with me. I brought a 12 and 12. They had paper and pen. And I did it. And it's really funny how bad of an inventory it is. What it was, what I did was a grudge list. I did on page 65. I did that. I'm resentful at the cause affects my whole world was on there. All the things that y'all did to me, they did to me, mom did to me, la 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 la, dad didn't love, blah 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 blah, all that. I didn't turn the page to page 67 where it says, "Setting aside the wrongs others have done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes." I didn't do that. I just did that grudge list. That's my first inventory. But it's a really effective inventory for 2 reasons at least. One, in order to do a second inventory, you have to do a first one. You can't just jump to your second inventory. To do 3, you got to have done 2. To do continuous inventory, you got to start somewhere. I have done more inventories the last 10 years of my sobriety than the first 28 combined. That's not an overstatement. But when I went through my first divorce, that's when I really found the magic of these inventories. When I had to look for me and my part and the things that happened here. And I found the magic in these inventories. And I've really found it, really gotten to the point where I do. If I wake up at 3 in the morning thinking about something, a someone, and then again at 5, and then again at 6, I got a resentment. That's a resentment. And I get up and that morning, I'll go to my desk and I will do an inventory. During tax season last year, a couple years ago, I didn't have time. But you know what? I did. I put that. And you know what? I did that inventory. And you know who I came and did the fifth with? Tim Whitcomb. My bro, man, here I am in Santa Barbara. Tim was the man who made a huge difference in my life. If I could come to Alcoholics Anonymous and not trust anybody, if I could stay sober and not trust, I would do it. Because I hate trust. Trust just gets me hurt. It gets us hurt. I ain't unique. But Tim Whitcomb was the first man I ever trusted. The first person I ever, ever really trusted. And that man, I remember one time I was doing an inventory. It's a true story. I was doing an inventory. It was a relationship inventory. And there was some stuff on there that was kind of weird, man. not that weird, but just... But it was weird enough that I'm like, man, who am I going to do this fifth step with? Because my sponsor's long distance on the phone, and, you know, and while I was thinking that, my phone is up. It was up on a... It was tilted up at me like that. And while it was up like that, my phone rang, and it was Tim Whitcomb. And I went, holy crap. I was thinking to myself, who am I going to do this fifth step with? And Tim Whitcomb called. And he talked to me about whatever it was he needed to say. And I said, hey, man, here's what I've got. You got any time? Can I come down? And, you know, we're 41 hour away. The next morning, during tax season, I drove down here to his house when he was in the place on Garden, or not Garden, the house he'd been in the last few years before he passed, and did that inventory with him. Got a hug, got back in my truck, and drove back up. That's the Alcoholics Anonymous, how Alcoholics Anonymous has become for me. And it's taken a long time. You know, like I said, start craving sober. I didn't come here to work some stupid steps. I didn't come here to be of service to anybody and pick up cigarette butts, pour coffee. I came here to not drink, man. That's all I was trying to do. If I went to a meeting, I might get called on it. Rarely, but I might. And if they called on me, I'd say something like, if you don't drink and you don't use, no matter how you do it, you're not wrong. And you know what would happen? They wouldn't call on me again, man. That's what would happen. And I'd punish that meeting and quit going to it. If they're not going to call on me, I ain't going to go. And within a relatively short period of time, I was punishing a whole lot of meetings and not attending many at all. Stark raving sober, man. My idea of insanity is any early Jack Nicholson movie. You know, The Shining, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That's insanity. I'm not like that. Therefore, I don't need to be restored to sanity. Thank you very much. After the psych ward, when I started paying attention a little bit more, a person said to me, I used to be a diehard Charger fan. I'm still a big football fan, but when they moved to L.A., no thank you. L.A. is the enemy to me. San Diego, L.A., you know, I grew up in San Diego. But anyways, so growing up in, where was I going with that? Remember?
Insanity.
Oh, the insanity. Oh, yeah, a woman said to me, yeah, she said, get a case of Coca-Cola on Sunday morning and drink it while you watch your football game. I'm like, are you kidding me? No. That's stupid. That's insane. She goes, exactly. Make it Coors or Budweiser. Well, yeah, that's doable. That's insane thinking, because that's exactly the same amount of liquid. And I'm like, oh, that's what they're talking about. But this God thing, man, I didn't want to hear about God. You want to have a God in your life, great. But don't talk to me about God. I'm one of the ones that my brain snaps shut, like it talks about in the Big Book, when you guys mention God. I didn't want to hear about God. And then, my first spiritual experience, I used to share that the only reason I didn't get drunk those first 5.5 years is that I got lucky. I got lucky. How many people come in and out? I got lucky. And I believed it. I believed that I just got lucky. And I was at a meeting, and this guy named Brian, newcomer, 6 months sober, Catholic Brian, that's what his nickname was, because he was very Catholic. And he came up to me after the meeting, and he said, you know what, Lee, you didn't get lucky. He said, you had a God in your life looking out for you, and you didn't even believe in him. And it hit, man. It wasn't like a bolt of lightning, or I got a sudden wind and believed, fell to my knees and believed in God. But I just found something. I can't explain it. If you've had it happen to you, you get it. And if you haven't, hopefully you'll stick around and it'll happen for you too. And I found a God of my understanding. And then someone else said, get on your knees and pray. And I'm like, nah, real men don't get on their knees and pray. You tell me one movie John Wayne got on his knees, man. Clint Eastwood was a preacher in Pale Rider. He didn't get on his knees. No. But then someone said something. You don't hear it much anymore, but the old school trick, but it worked for me. What someone said is put your shoes underneath your bed at night. And while you're down there, say a quick prayer. And I was like, well, all right, I can maybe do that. So drew the shades and locked the door and then got on my knees and prayed. Right? And I'll never forget that first time when I stood up off my knees. I felt something in my soul. Can't explain it. And it wasn't like I fell and all of a sudden I'm religious and was going to church. But I felt something. And I've been getting on my knees and praying every night and every morning almost since. For the first couple years, there were days I might have forgotten, but not anymore. It's pretty consistent. Me and Felina, every night I get on my knees, grab her hand, and when I roll out of bed in the morning, she's still sleeping, but I still pray, you know, right there. And it's made a huge difference in my life. And there's a couple things I'll share about that. And, you know, you could be like me, you know, one of those ones where I came in here and don't want to hear about God, don't believe in God, don't nothing to do. And I heard about a guy, his sponsor, he was like me and us, that didn't want to have anything to do with God. And his sponsor told him to go out to Yosemite and go be in the wilderness and find God in Yosemite. So he went out to Yosemite and he was trying to find God. He was hiking and he couldn't find God. And then he saw a bear, a big old grizzly bear coming towards him. And he's like, oh no. And he started to run. And the bear was running after him. He looked over his shoulder. He tripped and fell. He looked up and the bear was right over with a big paw, drooling. And he yelled out, oh God. And the bear froze. And there was lightning in the sky. And there's a voice from the heavens said, oh, you're getting a little trouble. And now you believe in me. And he goes, God? He goes, yeah, this is God. You're in a little trouble, and now you reach out for me? And he goes, yeah. He goes, so now you believe? And the guy said, man, if I believe in you and go back to AA, those guys are going to make fun of me. They're going to tease me because all those times I shared about not believing in God, there is no God, now all of a sudden you come. And so I tell you what, why don't you, instead of me believing, why don't you make the bear believe? God said, all right, let the stroke of lightning. And then the bear put his hands together. Thank you, God, for this food. And the bear ran away. I mean, the guy ran away. The guy ran away and got home. Now, here's the deal. He got back, and now he found a God of his understanding. And the thing of it is, none of us, no person in Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody in Alcoholics that working a program, will be proud of you. We'll be happy for you. We don't care. You can, any God you want, you can have it. We don't care in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can have whatever you want. Working, not everybody in here is working a program. Whether they're 30 days, 60 days, or 30 years, not everybody is working a program. I heard it said before, there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I don't like. Debbie's 50 years sober. And Debbie said that. There are people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I don't like. And I went, yes, me too, woohoo. But then she finished, and she said, but they don't know I don't like them. Which ties into my daily review every day. Every day, there's a part of my daily review on page 86 where it says, was I kind and loving to all? Kind and loving to all. But wait a minute, that's not fair. I'm kind and loving to those of you who are kind and loving to me. I'm kind and loving to you who like me. But I have that innate ability to know if you don't like me, I can sense it. If you don't like me, and I'm going to not like you first. And then what happens? And then just by self-fulfilling prophecy, maybe you're just having a bad day and I took it personally. It wasn't about me at all. But it ties in. If I was kind and loving to all, and I don't have kind and loving to all, I got it. The clock's up here. If I'm kind and loving to all, then those that I don't like don't even know it. It's amazing. When I put that on, when I ask myself, was I kind and loving to all, I can say yes. And you know what? It feels pretty good, man. It feels good to be kind and loving to everybody. A couple of things. This God thing. I told you what happened there. I started going to church after that happened. And I went to Santa Cruz Mountains on a men's retreat with a Christian church. And at 2 a.m. one morning, I accepted Christ. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm Christian now. That's great. That's fine. That's what happened for me. Christian, going to church a little bit, being part of this Christian fellowship. One of my daughters, Emily, her major in college was religion. And she invited me one time up to upstate New York to this Buddhist monastery, Thin Nhat Hanh, that part of the Buddhist religion. And it changed my life. I can't go into the details in the interest of time, but I learned to meditate. I wasn't meditating. I was 27 years sober, something like that. I guess not 27, but 18, 20 years sober. No one asked. We asked, are you praying? We don't say, are you meditating? And if you did, we could say, yeah, but we really aren't, or I wasn't. I don't know how to meditate. I can't cross my legs like that anyway, so I'm not going to, I can't, oh, no thanks. But that's not what meditation is, and the Buddhists don't care. The Buddhists don't care. They just put me in a room, and put us all in a room, and we meditated. And I found this, I slowed down. And then the other thing about New York is that they have these boroughs in New York, and we got into New York City now, and these boroughs, these ethnicities of Cubans and Puerto Ricans, and these Jews, the Hasidic Jews, have a borough or they're part of New York City. And the Hasidic Jews are so, 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 so proud of who they are and their heritage. And I'm Jewish. right? My mom, my grandparents are full-on Jewish. My mom left Florida, came out to California, and left all that behind. And they had me. I wasn't in Florida, but had me in California. So Judaism is part of my heritage, but I knew nothing about it. And I saw them, and I said, wow, God, I want to know more about my Jewish heritage. The next day, I'm flying out of New York City, and a young Hasidic Jew walks up to me. You can tell by their hair and their beard and their dress. And he said, are you Jewish? If he'd asked me the prior 40 years of my life, I would have said no. Because I didn't know. But I am. And I said, well, yeah, actually. And he said, we need you. I said, what? He said, we need you. And in the Jewish faith, they have this thing called a minyan. And what a minyan is 10 or more, but 10, have to have a minimum of 10 men praying together. They had 9. I was their 10th. I can only recently tell this story without crying. You know, I cried. They were praying in Hebrew, man. I don't know what they said, but I was part of it with them. The day before I told God I want to know more about my Jewish heritage, the next day I'm praying with 10 Jewish men and crying like a baby. I'm not thinking of John Wayne or Clint Eastwood, man. I'm proud to be part of it. So, and why I bring all that up is I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with my mind snapping shut when you mentioned God, and now I consider myself a Christian Buddhist Jew. And you know what? And that works in Alcoholics Anonymous, absolutely. Running out of time. I got to talk a little bit about Danny and Cody and those. So Danny here up front. Danny drove down with Billy from Santa Maria. We take an H&I group. We do H&I. We do everything. We're an active pocket of enthusiasm in our group of alcohol. And we go into detox. We went in. Any of y'all do detox? You know, when you go in there, and some of y'all in the back, and this is you, I know. You let us know. You can care less that we're there. Danny was that guy. Danny can let us know when we walked in. He was not interested. You know, blah, blah, blah. You know, by the end, and I bring in on my panel mostly women. And it's not, it's a sexist thing. It's because when you go in on a panel and you have mostly women, the men in a detox pay attention and they're more respectful. Yeah, it's true. I'm sorry. Not on sauce. No, I'm not. It's a truth. And well, this story of where, by the end of the meeting, Danny had turned around smiling like he is now. And we have questions at the end of the meeting. And Danny asked a few questions. The next day was a Saturday. And I picked a few of the guys up from detox and took them to the big speaker meeting in San Luis Obispo. It was Bank Robber Dave. You probably had him up here. But the point of it is that Danny came too, and we greeted, and we thanked the speaker, and we put away chairs. And Danny's got out of detox now, and he's active. He's got a couple commitments. But that night I asked Danny, hey, what happened, man? What made you go from how you were when we walked in to how you are now? And he said, it was homegirl, man. It was homegirl. It was, and it wasn't because she was pretty, young, blonde, nothing. It wasn't about that. It was something that she said, and because she was there, he paid attention. He was paying attention, and it made a difference. Now, you'd have to ask him more about it, but that's the story as I understand it. If you could be arrested for being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, would there be enough evidence to convict you? I would go away for life one day at a time. No doubt about it. Why? Because I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys. It is absolutely the best thing that ever happened to me. And if you go, if you don't understand why I could say something like that, then I hope you stick around long enough that it happens to you too, because it will. Thank you. I love you.
Everyone, my name is Jordan and I'm your alcoholic secretary. Let's thank Lee one more time.